The European Union's top diplomat says the bloc has no choice but to hold talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's outgoing ambassador to the UN in Geneva accuses the Taliban of breaking their promises to safeguard women and protect human rights. Ukraine says one of its soldiers has been killed by pro-Russia separatists east of the country. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with some comments by European Union's foreign policy chief, who is saying that the 27-nation bloc has no choice but to hold talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan.
To have any chance of influencing events, we have no other options but to engage with the Taliban. Engaging doesn't mean recognition. Not. But engaging means talking, discussing, and agreeing when possible.
Now, in his address to the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, Borrell also said that Brussels would seek to coordinate with European governments to organize a diplomatic presence in Kabul. The top diplomat added the bloc would stress the importance of human rights in talks with the Taliban, even though this may be a quote pure oxymoron. Last week, the EU criticized the Taliban after they announced the formation of a provisional government in Afghanistan. It said the government is neither inclusive nor representative of Afghanistan's ethnic and religious diversity. The bloc has, for now, frozen more than 1 billion euros in development funds to Afghanistan. Now, let's go to Brussels. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, is there, and definitely he's watching all of this. Jerome, good to have you with us. How serious is the European Union? Do they simply have to do it, what's the story?
Well, it was a fascinating debate, Behrouz. It's actually still going on at the moment, this debate in the European Parliament. It's been going on for the past 2 hours. And Joseph Borrell, as you say, the EU foreign policy chief, he spoke first. And he did talk about, he was critical of the new government in Afghanistan, but he talked about the need to keep channels open and to talk. And he also went on then to say, you know, what does all of this mean, this whole debacle? What does it mean for the future of EU-US relations? And then he talked about the need, you know, for EU military expansion. And there's no secret, Behrouz, that, you know, Borrell is massively in favor of an EU army. And this is one of the sort of reactions he believes is necessary to what we've seen in Afghanistan. And I counted at least 10 MEPs, EU legislators, who stood up and were furious with these remarks. Because they're saying, look, the last answer to all of this is more military, is more spending on arms. They were absolutely furious with his remarks, that actually it appears that he's taking the opportunity and the misery that's been caused in Afghanistan to actually argue for the expansion of an EU army. So really, there were a lot of contributions in the parliament, and a number of MEPs also said, look, this proves we need to stop interfering in foreign nations, stop being led by the United States, stop being led by NATO, which is led by Washington, to go into these nations and cause all this havoc and destruction and hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths. People, the lawmakers were furious about this. And then we had many others talking about the humanitarian response, that we need to keep humanitarian aid going to Afghanistan and to support surrounding countries that are taking in so many refugees. And also that we need to take more refugees here in the European Union, that we cannot close our borders. There are a number of EU leaders, we know them well, you know, led perhaps by Viktor Orban in Hungary, but also, you know, Austria, Czech Republic, the list goes on. They just do not want any refugees. And so there's a feeling, and if you listen to the likes of Oxfam, they're saying that the EU is effectively Fortress Europe, that they're closing off the borders to these desperate people. So you heard all of this in the European Parliament. One MEP also made the point during the debate, the lengthy debate, which is still ongoing, that, you know, she quoted Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, who said that Afghanistan was not the source of a major terrorist problem. And so that calls into question why, for 2 decades, did Western powers go in there and destroy the country and destabilize that area, destabilize the region, and again create so many, all those deaths and all the people that have been wounded, and now we see a massive refugee crisis. So all of this is to play for. It's all been discussed today, and the point also has been made by one of the EU agencies, the European Economic and Social Committee. It has released a statement earlier saying what's really necessary, instead of the usual rhetoric from the likes of Joseph Borrell in terms of, you know, EU armies and EU military and so on, is that really there needs to be really meaningful cooperation and engagement with countries surrounding Afghanistan, you know, like Iran, Pakistan, China and India and Russia, meaningful dialogue with these countries to try and bring stability to Central Asia.
Okay, thanks for that. Jerome Hughes in Brussels. Now, the outgoing Afghan envoy to the United Nations in Geneva has slammed the Taliban for breaking their promises to safeguard women and human rights. Nasser Ahmed Andisha urged the international community to hold the Taliban to account for neglecting human rights. He noted that Afghanistan's national unity, political diversity, and women's rights are being undermined by the newly formed interim government. He also accused the Taliban of conducting widespread atrocities in the Panjshir Valley. The Taliban have rejected the allegations. The group says it will support women's rights in an Islamic context and that a new government will consult the population on an inclusive future permanent system. Qatar has warned it won't take responsibility for its operations at the Kabul airport without a clear agreement with all sides involved, including the Taliban.
We need to make sure that everything is addressed very clearly, otherwise we are not going to take any responsibility of the airport if all these things are not addressed and becoming very clear.
The Qatari foreign minister says that Doha is still negotiating the status of the airport, noting that a lot of issues regarding the operations remain unclear. Last week, Qatar helped the airport operate again after it was severely damaged during a chaotic evacuation of U.S.-led foreign forces from Afghanistan. Qatar Airways also operated several charter flights out of Kabul last week. On Monday, a Pakistani passenger plane became the first foreign commercial flight to arrive there since the Taliban's takeover. Moving on, a group of Palestinians have gone on a strike in the Akbar al-Quds in solidarity with prisoners in Israeli jails. They stopped working in Isawiya neighborhood. They slammed Israel's treatment of the inmates and called on the international community to take action. On Monday, some 1,400 prisoners in Israeli jails announced an open-ended hunger strike. They said that their action will begin on Friday. The inmates want to the Tel Aviv regime to end what they call as a policy of repression and abuse. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have also held a rally in solidarity with thousands of inmates in Israeli jails. Mona Kandil has an update on the situation of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails following the escape of six of them last week.
Last week, a number of cells were set up, please, by the Palestinian prisoners, especially that Israeli soldiers were all the day raiding their cells, attacking them, taking from their properties. They get inside their cells, transferring Palestinian prisoners by groups, not from a cell to another, but from a prison to another. This is very difficult on the prisoners. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are threatening. If the Israeli soldiers do not stop their aggression and their violent attacks on the Palestinian prisoners all over the Israeli jails, then they will start a strike, an open-ended hunger strike. We are speaking about 1,380 Palestinian prisoners will start the hunger strike on Friday. Now the Palestinian prisoners are saying they will not accept any attack on them, and they are demanding the international community to act, not to only condemn the illegal Israeli practices, and they are threatening more escalation, not only an open-ended hunger strike to start on Friday.
In other news, lawmakers in the European Parliament have condemned the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel for engaging in illegal practice of spying on EU citizens. Experts told the Parliament that the scale of the problem goes far beyond than what's known. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes has the story.
It has been known for a long time that the United States is guilty of espionage against its closest ally, the European Union. The matter has just been debated in the European Parliament. It is time the 27-nation bloc had its own intelligence agency to respond, lawmakers suggest.
Le 30 mai dernier.
Just look at the 30th of May. Media investigations showed that Denmark and the NSA cooperated in spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French, Norwegian, Swedish, German journalists.
The fact that EU member Denmark has been working with the US to spy on other EU nations is surely a scandal. Also, Israel has been condemned in the European Parliament for selling its Pegasus military spyware to Saudi Arabia so that Riyadh can hack into the phones of EU politicians, government advisers, lawyers, journalists and academics.
How do you think the world should approach the Israeli government in regards to its involvement? What should be the precedence so that we deter such cases in the future?
The answer, critics argue, is that EU authorities will do nothing because they are afraid of upsetting Washington, Riyadh and Tel Aviv. Some claim motives for this activity given by the US do not add up.
I think America uses the terrorism concept a lot to promote its surveillance agenda. And that's a concern because I think the actual figures of persons who are afflicted by terrorism is actually quite small.
Turning a blind eye to the problem is an insult to citizens, one expert told the European Parliament debate.
All intelligence activity impinges on human rights. It just does. So it impacts on your right to enjoyment, maybe freedom of movement, it might be right to communication and all the rest of it. So the key point there is on the legality.
Another expert who was invited to the debate told legislators that we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to foreign nations spying on the EU. Margarita Carrillo from the University of Canada warned that this problem is never going to go away, and therefore EU authorities need to come up with a firm plan in order to preserve the bloc's much talked about values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ukraine says one of its soldiers has been killed in fresh clashes with pro-Russia forces in the country's volatile east. The army said that pro-Russian separatists targeted military positions along the front lines with mortar, grenades, launchers, and machine guns. This is the fourth casualty on the Ukrainian side over the past 3 days as tensions resurfaced. Ukraine has been locked in a conflict with pro-independence groups in the east since Crimea Peninsula rejoined Russia following a referendum in April 2014. Kiev accuses Moscow of sending troops and arming anti-Ukraine fighters, and that's a charge that the Kremlin denies. A peace deal signed in Minsk has failed to end the fighting in eastern Ukraine. Staying with Europe, the British government says it's delaying the implementation of post-Brexit border checks on goods from the EU for a second time, blaming the coronavirus pandemic and supply problems for the decision. In a statement, London announced that all border controls on food and agricultural products will be postponed until July 2022. It said the delays apply mainly to co-sanitary and phytosanitary goods coming from EU member states. The measures had been postponed before and were due to come into force in October, and this as the country is facing problems in its food sector, with many shops and supermarkets running out of some imported products. The UK left the EU in January last year. Under the Brexit deal, Northern Ireland remains in the EU's single market, but checks are imposed on goods moving between there and the UK. North Korea says the new cruise missiles it has recently tested will act as a potent deterrent against hostile forces. The test launch, however, has drawn criticism from Washington. The U.S. says it remains prepared to engage with the North, but the question is, will a new round of talks produce any different results than the others the two sides have held so far?
On Sunday, North Korea said it has successfully test-fired a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend, the first missile launch by the country since March. According to North Korea's official news agency, KCNA, the missiles deployed during the test flew 1,500 kilometers before hitting their designated targets inside the country's territorial waters. In response, the United States military accused North Korea of posing threats to Pyongyang's regional neighbors and the international community. The North Korean outlet, however, described the new missile as having strategic significance, which will help the country counter aggression from foreign forces. The announcement has led experts to speculate that the missiles are nuclear capable, but so far, it's unclear whether Pyongyang has perfected the technology needed to make warheads small enough to fit into cruise missiles.
The new technique and strategy has been sanctions, has been chastising DPRK for having a defensive nuclear program that has never been launched. It's not the DPRK that has launched nuclear war against Japan. They didn't launch the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was the U.S. imperialists who did so.
The agency called the weapon a key element in a five-year plan outlined in January to further advance the nuclear-armed country's defense science and arsenals. It added that the development of the most recently tested missiles took 2 years to complete.
The number of coronavirus-related deaths in Iran has dropped for the third consecutive day as the country is speeding up the vaccination rollout. The health ministry announced 408 new fatalities over the past day, pushing the death toll to above 115,000. The country also registered some 22,000 new infections. So far, more than 5.3 million cases have been confirmed in Iran. The latest daily figures show a marked decline since late August, as Iran was struggling with the fifth wave of the virus. The country has administered some 38 million doses of jabs, with the health minister expressing hope that Iran would top the vaccination ranking this week. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, truthfulness and thankfulness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. The Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, said, "Truthfulness is the word of Allah in this heaven and earth. It cuts everything it touches. If you want to know whether you are truthful or lying, then look into the truthfulness of what you mean and the conclusion of your claim. Then gauge them both according to a scale from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as if you were present on the day of resurrection, the day of judgment. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 7, verse number 8 of the Holy Quran has said, "And measuring out on that day will be just." You know, the ruling system on that day is going to be the divine justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is what we need to know. Yes, the mercy of Allah is going to be there as well for those who deserve it. But the by default system on the day of resurrection, the day of judgment, through which Allah is going to punish or reward human beings, is His divine justice. We definitely hope and pray for the mercy of Allah to be there, but this is going to be an exception for all of us. If there is balance and harmony in what you mean, then your claim is successful, and your truthfulness is in the fact that the tongue does not differ from the heart, nor the heart from the tongue. The truthful person with this description is like the angel who draws out his soul. If the soul is not drawn out, then what is it to do? Remember, your tongue and your heart, your intentions, your state of heart, they have to be in coherence and they have to be in sync. This is when you become truthful. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing truthfulness and thankfulness. Before the break, we went over what it means to be truthful. How can we gauge? How can we find out? Let's discuss a bit about thankfulness. Brothers and sisters, with every breath we take, a thanksgiving is incumbent upon us. Indeed, 1,000 thanks or more. The lowest level of gratitude is to see that the blessing comes from Allah, irrespective of the cause of it, and without the heart being attached to that cause. It consists of being satisfied with what is given. It means not disobeying Allah with regard to His blessing or opposing Him in any of His commands and prohibitions because of His blessing. Be a grateful bondsman to Allah in every way, and you will find that Allah is a generous Lord in every way. If there were a way of worshipping Allah for His sincerest bondsmen to follow more excellent than giving thanks at every instance, He would have ascribed to them the name of this worship above the rest of the creation. Thankfulness is something that is essential for our spiritual, moral, and health growth. When we are thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in Quran He promised that if you thank me, I will increase it. Saying thanks is not just lip service. Thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala comes with and has to come with your actions and your subservience towards Allah. Do dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Simple question.
The Ministry of Defence in central London has been busy since 2001. That's when the United Kingdom and America invaded Afghanistan to drive out Taliban forces. Some say this politically motivated escapade owed as much to gesture politics as it did to any military objective. After initial success in limiting the area of operations of the Taliban, the battle for hearts and minds began to be lost as the attempt to win through military power failed the West.
Britain has been closely involved with the campaign in Afghanistan. It is, in fact, just an example of similar initiatives involving Britain in Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. There is no sign that the British government will shift away from this militaristic approach as the UK struggles to adapt its international strategies in a new world order where it is not as powerful as it once was. All this war has damaged these countries in economic, social, and political ways. The public are deprived of health, housing, and safety. Businesses fail. Politicians compete to control anarchic and angry populations, with the ever-present prospect of insurgency. Since the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, has been key to much of this action, some argue NATO has served to destabilize the entire Middle East, while making Britain more of a target for enemies.
So what was the result of this and other military escapades in the Middle East and the surrounding region? Will the UK choose peaceful solutions in future? Or is the financial incentive just too great for the UK to give up on the arms industry? These are simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do people here in central London feel about the UK's military involvement in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Iraq? We put that to the public. Here's what they told us.
I don't think the British public know enough about what's going on there. I myself, I used to live in the Middle East. I know nothing about any kind of wars or any bad. I was an Emirat. I was in the Emirates, and I was an expat there, and I knew nothing but positivity and just so, I'm so accepted by the Emirati people, and yet we hear all this stuff about Iran and Iraq and all this Afghanistan, but what is actually happening? What is the problem? I don't feel like I know.
Well, to be honest, as a country, we've always got involved in everybody else's problems as a way to benefit this country, and it's about time to stop sticking their nose in.
I think UK should put more active participation. I don't think the country is doing enough in terms of global causes. So my view is that it should, being a superpower, it should rather be taking into account what's going around as well. Yeah. So that's, they might be doing it to a certain extent, but that's not enough with whatever is happening around. So.
Well, I'm born in Afghanistan, so I kind of was at first hand the situation there, my parents, how they had to flee, and we've obviously come over here to start a new life. I get it from a government point of view. We've got to take action. When there are regimes like the Taliban that unfortunately, at the cost of civilians and normal people, need to be addressed, they need to be challenged. But at the same time, in the last 20 years, the occupation, the alliance forces, how much good have they done? And now that they're leaving, what will that leave? What legacy will that leave? So I'm kind of, I don't know enough to kind of say one way or the other. I am skeptical, but also I appreciate the intervention is necessary, because there are countries where, you know, leaders, dictators go on and on for decades. They don't take the country forward. So I appreciate the intervention, but I don't know if it was in the last 20 years.
Our involvement in all those wars has always been a disaster. I think we first invaded Afghanistan 200 years ago. There's never been anything in any of those wars that hasn't left a worse position. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people killed, and usually chaos. I was born in 1945. I grew up in that post-war world where we were told all our wars were about trying to create a democracy. They weren't. They're about getting control of oil in the Middle East and making money out of all of these things. We never created a democracy anywhere.
The 21st century has been a century of war for Britain. In fact, the last years of the 20th century were also in the era of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and the so-called Chicago Doctrine, the so-called right to protect, although they're highly discriminating in whom they intend to protect, and of course end up killing vast numbers of people in order to protect them, like the famous American general in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, who said we had to destroy that village in order to save it. It has been a colossal blunder, as well as a terrifically large crime, one of the great crimes of British history, and we have many crimes in British history. The invasion and occupation of first Afghanistan, then Iraq, the destruction of Libya, the attempt to destroy Syria, the participation in the no war but no peace with Iran, the participation in the attacks on the poorest people in the region in Yemen, have all been a shameful mark on the British record, which, as I say, has many centuries of such marks.
What does the public feel was actually achieved by the UK's military action in and around the Middle East over the last 20 years?
Well, we haven't achieved anything. So my husband was out there, fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're now looking at, we're going back again. So we haven't achieved anything. It's done full circle. So we haven't got anywhere. Hasn't done anything.
They just continue to disrupt it. That's all the intention is. I'm not particularly very happy with the way that we kind of manage ourselves and what we've done in the Middle East. It's not very good.
Nothing at all. Like I said, I've never heard any good come out of it. We're going, keep going back and spending all this money. I don't know on what at all. So nothing at all.
Should ask my son, who studied GCSE. You know, he was taught, this is what he studied, which was the Middle East, and, you know, from, you know, Ben Gurion and all the setting up of that. To be honest, it seems to be, it's dominated by the American politics, not necessarily British politics, but by supporting, I suppose, Americans. The British are seen as being complicit in terms of what they're doing. What do I think? As I said, there are sides to both. There are both sides in terms of what there are. You know,
the Middle East hasn't moved on a whole lot in the last 20 years, but the UK has been involved for 800 years in many different places. It depends on, as I said, the purpose. If you're not seeing any improvements, you have to question why you're there.
If I think back, I mean, we have never been involved anywhere in the Middle East that hasn't been a disaster. I mean, I grew up really worried that one day I'd have to join the army and I'd be sent. I grew up really worried that I'd be forced into the army, I'd end up in a war somewhere in the Middle East. And the simple fact is that literally all this has been about the control of oil, not about democracy or defending people's rights. We have been responsible, along with America. We've been the number two in this. America's been the main lead in all of this. And hundreds of thousands of people have died because of it. And we've ended up with a legacy of really unpleasant dictatorial regimes. Where in the Middle East have we created a nice democracy? We haven't.
Well, nothing good has been achieved for Britain, that's for sure. The demonstration that I talked about, which is a demonstration of the United States' fading power rather than growing power, has pushed people together, for example, that might not otherwise have ended up together. It's pushed Russia and China together, almost as one country, economically speaking, currency-wise, militarily. It has, in strategic politics, it has pushed China and Russia together, making a very powerful adversary indeed. It has emboldened fanatic Takfiri extremism all over the world, including in our own country. I've just been reading the inquest details of the Takfiri murderer who went wild in a street I used to live in, a man who had been in maximum security from the age of 16 and by the age of 20 was dead, but having stabbed multiple innocent people in between those two dates. It has, of course, created a new bloc in the world, which involves Iran, China, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, and so on, which will not be in the United States imperial interest to have done.
The UK is a pivotal part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that's NATO. But with all this military activity, when it comes to keeping the British public safe, has the UK's involvement in NATO done more harm than good?
to be honest, I just think we're in it because we're Britain, and that's it. We have to be part of it. I don't think we achieve anything from it. It's just to say that we're involved in it, but America will just do whatever they can for themselves, I think.
It's hard to say. I mean, you look at the July attack, you look at 2000, obviously, in the US, and you look at lots of the terrorist attacks. Where does it come from? Where does it boil down to? And it's, you know, individuals, again, making that decision based on perhaps an ideology, their own personal views, and they go and act. So would a government decision or would a treaty like the NATO treaty prevent that? I don't know. And when it was set up, it was a great idea. And again, I appreciate what it can help with, but does it go far enough? Are these people that are sitting around talking about these situations and then putting actions in place, is it going far enough to really drive into the root cause of these individuals that are acting?
I believe they should. I mean, every country should have the have a freedom to equip themselves. But as long as it's been used for surveying the borders, yeah, not for sort of putting pressure on other countries. Yeah. So yes, every country has the right to sort of equip themselves with whatever weapons and whatever things they need to do to secure their boundaries. So I have no problem with that. Yeah.
If anything, we seem to be going in the opposite direction in the last 10 years. Maybe in the early years there was some improvements, but it's definitely stoked fires, not just the UK, everybody's involvement, because there's different purposes for you being there. And in short, no, in the recent years, it's probably getting worse. And that's because any time you step into somebody's territory and use certain tactics, you're going to upset people. And it does. You don't have to go too far. You can come back locally and realise that if you continue with the same policies that don't seem to be working, you're going to upset people, and people will start to turn around and see what they can do. And if there isn't another power, another government that can support them, they'll start to take on that pressure themselves and revolt.
Basically, when NATO was set up just after the end of the Second World War, we were being told we were under a threat from the Soviet Union, Russia. And we now know, given all the data has been released, there was never a threat. Stalin had no intention of attacking the West. This was all about creating this military complex that we controlled Europe, not the Soviet Union. And the simple fact is people should have been allowed to create their own governments in their own time. We were involved in so many wars throughout all my life. It's been every single one of them. It's been not about democracy. It's been about economic interests.
Britain's involvement in NATO is an extremely expensive way of defending ourselves, even though we, in fact, have no discernible enemies that could attack us beyond the very Takfiri extremist terrorists that we have been doing so much to help in places like Libya, in places like Syria. NATO is no defense at all against a man with a samurai sword in a park going around cutting people's heads off. Britain has no nuclear enemy and no country, no state, which is conceivably going to pose a risk to British security. So we're paying a lot of money and paying a high political price for being involved with, you call it NATO, but it's really just the United States' gang, you know. And it would be quickly dispensed with if other NATO countries began to oppose American adventurism in Latin America, for example. Not many people know that well-known North Atlantic power, Colombia, is currently a candidate member for NATO. But if any country or group of countries began to oppose NATO's involvements in different parts of the world, it would quickly be dispensed with. This is the United States' coalition of the killing.
The direct cost to America of the Afghanistan conflict is estimated at $2 trillion. In terms of death toll, in Libya, deaths are estimated at 30,000. The figure in Afghanistan is over 115,000 dead. In Yemen, the number exceeds 130,000. For Syria, those killed has passed 500,000. And for Iraq, it exceeds 600,000. Thus, the total official estimate of dead in these five countries alone is 1.375 million. This is almost certainly an underestimate.
After 20 years of war in Afghanistan and elsewhere, does the public think the UK will choose a more peaceful approach in the future, or will the next 20 years just be more of the same?
Not really. I have a cousin who works in the army in Israel, and it looks like it's something that's going to keep going on forever. There's always some sort of massive thing breaking out, and loads of people are dying and feeling terrified. So, I don't know.
When you go into a country to make things better, but have a backdoor deal to sell arms, that may not be directly, maybe indirectly going back to that source country as well, you have to question it.
I don't think so. Human nature, you know, we have this territorial kind of ideology, or I don't know. I guess it's a person's fitness of survival of the fittest. Sorry, the Darwin's theory, and we group together, and we want to have our own sort of space. And I think we should educate ourselves a bit better. We should help each other, support each other, and hopefully bring about change within ourselves in order to impact the environment, the community that we live in. And we'll be living in a better place, but I don't know if we'll ever remove conflict, because that's just human nature.
More the same. I can't see this ending. I can't see how this is actually going to end. Like I said, I think it's just going to constantly just go round in circles. There is just no end to this, is there? Now we've started it, how do you end a war once you've started a war? There is no end, is there? It's tit for tat. It's just going to keep going round and round.
Well, it's quite clear. Now that America's pulled out, we've decided to pull out, it's going to be up to the people in Afghanistan. The trouble is, I'm not a supporter of the Taliban, of course. I mean, and imposing a religion on people is wrong. I want to live in a world where everyone is free to live their life as they choose, not to be told you've got to support this religion, that religion, live this or that life. Just let people be themselves.
Unfortunately, I think the next 20 years will be very much like the last 20 years. Beyond 20, no one could safely hazard a guess. But we are locked into this alliance with the United States. The United States is fading, but still dangerous. Even the broken teeth of an old tiger can bite. And as long as we're locked into being the tail of that old tiger, I'm afraid we'll have to follow the head.
The UK is the second biggest arms dealer in the Middle East behind America. How will British arms exports be affected following the global economic problems caused by COVID? And is Britain even more dependent on the arms trade now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. There's a lot of decisions that are driven by, and there's a lot of things that come out of that. You know, stopping that, would it prevent the wars that are happening, and would it prevent some of the issues that are in these countries, in Middle East, in Afghanistan, in other countries? I don't know. But certainly, again, the government needs to be taken to account for those actions and those trades and transactions. I understand that we're an economy. I understand that the life situation here is better. You know, if I was in Afghanistan and I'd grown up in Afghanistan, the education that I would have had would mean nothing compared to what I have had living in the UK. And I'm very grateful for that. But again, it needs to be taken into account, and it needs to be challenged, and we need to talk about it more and be more aware of it moving forward.
Well, I think probably it's going to mean that more countries seem to be more worried about it themselves, because they've got to look after what's happening in their own country. So they're maybe not looking and keeping an eye on what's going abroad very much, because the pandemic causes huge issues in your own country.
I hope not. I mean, I don't know too much about it, but I definitely hope that people will realise that it's not the way forward. But yeah, I'm, like I said, I don't really know much about it. but I don't think that it's a productive use of forces and money.
Well, we're not financially reliant. It's quite small as a proportion of our national economy. But the simple fact is, if you look at this, half of all the military spending in the world is by the United States of America. I mean, literally, every other country in the world together just equals what America spends on its military. And the tragedy is, all throughout most of my life, British governments, Labour or Conservative, have just been going along with what America wants. Fortunately, for my generation, the then Labour government, Harold Wilson, refused to get involved in the war in Vietnam. Otherwise, you wouldn't be interviewing me now. I'd be dead.
Well, where there's muck, there's brass, we say in this country. Where there are dirty things, there's money to be made. In this case, where there's brass in the form of arms exports, there's muck to be gathered. And the muck may be lucre, but it's filthy lucre. And I don't expect that to change. It's a symptom of Britain's industrial and manufacturing decline that just about the best things that we make nowadays are weapons. Weapons which, in the end, pierce the skin and the heads of overwhelmingly innocent people. A man's just gone to prison in the United States of America for 4 years for exposing the fact that drones, the kind of drones we routinely make and routinely sell and see routinely used, kill 90% innocent civilians. There's blood on the hands of Britain's weapons manufacturers, but they're not going to stop or go out of business anytime soon.
Since 2001, the UK has backed conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Britain is also the second largest arms exporter to the Middle East. Britain has therefore made literally billions of pounds worth of business through the sale and use of weapons in these countries and beyond.
Twenty years and countless deaths later, with the Taliban once again advancing in Afghanistan and the region in conflict, Britain has made a fortune out of war, but at the cost of lives and peace. The UK could change course tomorrow, but some suggest that for Britain PLC, war is just too profitable to let peace get in the way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.